The prevailing problem for these organizations is that the rest of us can't be bothered to participate in their surveys, focus groups, and taste tests. Even with sizable inducements in the form of cash payments, free products, or gift certificates, the percentage of people agreeing to cooperate can be low, which gives market researchers heartburn because they can't be sure the data they've collected reflect the feelings of the majority of their target group. Could these researchers eliminate their problem by requesting consumer information in the moment following a persuasive single-shoot question? Consider the results of an experiment performed by communication scientists San Bulkin and Peter Anderson, who approached people and made a request for assistance with a survey. We have all experienced something similar when a clipboard-carrying researcher stops us in a shopping mall or supermarket and asks for a few minutes of our time. As is the case for the typical shopping mall requester, these scientists' success was dismal. Only 29% of those asked to participate consented. But Bulkin and Anderson thought they could boost compliance without resorting to any of the costly payments that marketers often feel forced to employ. They stopped a second sample of individuals and began the interaction with a persuasive opener. Do you consider yourself a helpful person? Following brief reflection, nearly everyone answered yes. In that privileged moment, after subjects had confirmed privately and affirmed publicly their helpful natures, the researchers pounced, requesting help with their survey. Now 77.3% volunteered. In Chapter 10, we'll explore the particular psychological mechanism, a desire for consistency, that led people to become more than twice as likely to comply under these circumstances. But for now, let's derive a broader insight, one that is a major thesis of this book. Frequently, the factor most likely to determine a person's choice in a situation is not the one that counsels most wisely there. It is the one that has been elevated in attention, and thereby in privilege, at the time of the decision. This recognition allows us to think entirely differently than before about the influence process. For much of the 30-plus years that I have been studying the ways that people can be persuaded to choose and change, my thinking has been governed by the dominant scientific model of social influence. It advises as follows. If you wish to change another's behavior, you must first change some existing feature of that person so that it fits with the behavior. If you want to convince people to purchase something unfamiliar, let's say a new soft drink, you should act to transform their beliefs or attitudes or experiences in ways that make them want to buy the product. You might attempt to change their beliefs about the soft drink by reporting that it's the fastest growing new beverage on the market, or to change their attitudes by connecting it to a well-liked celebrity, or to change their experiences with it by offering free samples in the supermarket. Although an abundance of evidence shows that this approach works, it is now clear that there is an alternate model of social influence that provides a different route to persuasive success. Are you adventurous enough to consider a revolutionary model of influence? According to this non-traditional, channeled attention approach, to get desired action, it's not necessary to alter a person's beliefs or attitudes or experiences. It's not necessary to alter anything at all, except what's prominent in that person's mind at the moment of decision. In our example of the new soft drink, it might be the fact that in the past, he or she has been willing to look at new possibilities. Evidence for precisely this process can be found in an extension of the Bulkin and Anderson research, demonstrating that a marketer could greatly increase the chance of finding survey participants by beginning with a particular persuasive opener, asking people if they consider themselves helpful. In a companion study, The two scientists found that it was similarly possible to increase willingness to try an unfamiliar consumer product by beginning with a comparable but differently customized persuasive opener. This time, asking people if they consider themselves adventurous. The consumer product was a new soft drink, and individuals had to agree to supply an email address so they could be sent instructions on how to get a free sample. Half were stopped and asked if they wanted to provide their addresses for this purpose. Most were reluctant. Only 33% volunteered their contact information. The other subjects were asked initially, "Do you consider yourself to be somebody who is adventurous and likes to try new things?" Almost all said yes, following which 75.7% gave their email addresses. Two features of these findings strike me as remarkable. First, of the subjects who were asked if they counted themselves adventurous, 97%, 70 out of 72, responded affirmatively. The idea that nearly everybody qualifies as an adventurous type is ludicrous. Yet when asked the single-shoot question of whether they fit this category, people nominate themselves almost invariably. Such is the power of positive test strategy and the blinkered perspective it creates. The evidence shows that this process can significantly increase the percentage of individuals who brand themselves as adventurous or helpful or even unhappy. Moreover, the narrowed perspective, though temporary, is anything but inconsequential. For a persuasively privileged moment, it renders these individuals highly vulnerable to aligned requests, as the data of research scientists and the practices of cult recruiters attest. The other noteworthy feature of the soft drink experiment is not that a simple question could shunt so many people into a particular choice, but that it could shunt so many of them into a potentially dangerous choice. In recent years, if there is anything we have been repeatedly warned to safeguard against by all manner of experts, it's opening ourselves to some unscrupulous individual who might bombard our computers with spam, infect them with destructive viruses, or hack into them to sting us with the protracted misery of identity theft. Of course, to be fair, it must be acknowledged that experienced and discerning users are unlikely to be fooled by the offers they receive electronically. I, for instance, have been flattered to learn through repeated internet messages that many Ukrainian virgin prostitutes want to meet me. If that can't be arranged, they can get me an outstanding deal on reconditioned printer cartridges. Notwithstanding this particular exception, we'd be well advised to regard the authenticity of such solicitations skeptically. Indeed, given the mass of negative publicity regarding computer fraud, it makes great sense that 2/3 of Bulkin and Anderson's first group of subjects turned down the request for their email addresses. After all, this was a complete stranger who advanced on them unintroduced and unbidden. The circumstances clearly called for prudence. What's significant is that these circumstances applied equally to all those individuals. 75.6% in Bulkin and Anderson's second group, who, after being channeled to their adventurous sides by an initial single-shoot question, ignored the cues for caution and piled rashly into a potentially foolish choice. Their behavior, bewildering as it is on the surface, confirms this book's contention that the guiding factor in a decision is often not the one that counsels most wisely. It's one that has recently been brought to mind. But why? The answer has to do with the ruthlessness of channeled attention, which not only promotes the now focal aspect of the situation, but also suppresses all competing aspects of it, even critically important ones. The do's and don'ts of focused attention. In the English language, we are said to pay attention, which plainly implies that the process extracts a cost. Research on cognitive functioning shows us the form of the fee. When attention is paid to something, the price is attention to something else. Indeed, because the human mind appears able to hold only one thing in conscious awareness at a time, the toll is a momentary loss of focused attention to everything else. Have you ever noticed how difficult it is to genuinely experience two things at once? I know, for example, that if I start looking intently for a highway exit while listening to a CD in my car, I'll stop hearing the music. And if I am listening intently to the music, I'll often miss my exit. In this regard, my car's CD player is structured to work like my brain, allowing me but a single track of music at a time. That's for good reason, as it would be folly to play more than one simultaneously. I just hear noise. So it is with human cognition. Even though there are always multiple tracks of information available, we consciously select only the one we want to register at that moment. Any other arrangement would leave us overloaded and unable to react to distinct aspects of the mongrelized input. The best we can do to handle multiple channels of information is to switch back and forth among them, opening and closing the door of mindfulness to each in turn. This skill allows for multitasking, the ability to focus on several activities in the same time frame, perhaps talking on the phone while reading an email message. Although it might seem that we are concentrating on more than one thing simultaneously, that's an illusion. We are just rapidly alternating our focus. However, just as there is a price for paying attention, there is a charge for switching it. For about a half second during a shift of focus, we experience a mental dead spot, called an attentional blink, when we can't register the newly highlighted information consciously. It's for this reason that I am so annoyed when I'm interacting with an individual who is trying to do something else at the same time. Have you ever had a phone conversation with someone you can tell is engaged in another task? Maybe because you can hear newspaper pages turning or computer keys clicking. I hate that. It shows me that my conversation partner is willing to lose contact with the information I'm providing to make contact with some other information. It always feels like a form of demotion. It advises me that my input is considered relatively unimportant. But I'm not the only one it advises. It notifies my conversation partner of the same thing, because people rightly believe that what they choose to attend to, or away from, reflects what they value at the time. Here's the point for the influence process. Whatever we can do to focus people on something, an idea, a person, an object, makes that thing seem more important to them than before. Consider, for instance, a device used by the renowned psychotherapist Milton Erickson when dealing with patients who, over the course of treatment, had been unwilling to consider a point that Erickson felt was crucial to their progress. Perhaps that failure to choose is a form of personal choice. Rather than inviting more resistance by amplifying his voice the next time he made this point, he recognized the wisdom of doing the opposite. True to his reputation as a master moment maker, Dr. Erickson would wait for a heavy truck to begin climbing the hill outside his office window. Then, while timing his reintroduction of the crucial insight to coincide with the worst of the noise, he would lower his voice. To hear what Erickson was saying, patients had to lean forward into the information, an embodied signal of focused attention and intense interest. When asked about the tactic, Erickson, who was famous for orchestrating the nonverbal elements of effective therapy, attributed its success to the leaning in posture that patients assumed when trying to hear the information he wanted them to see as important. Instructive though it might be, we don't have to rely on this particular anecdote for evidence that people assign more significance to the things they see themselves choosing to move toward. As plenty of research shows that reducing the distance to an object makes it seem more worthwhile. Nor do we have to look far to see how this automatic tendency can affect the influence process. In one study, potential shoppers who just envisioned themselves moving toward, rather than away from, a container of snack food came to like it better, and were willing to pay over 4 times more to obtain it. Besides arranging for others to orient themselves toward messages and products, there are numerous other ways for communicators to get an audience to assign special attention and, consequently, special import to an idea or item. As we'll see next, the implications for the act of persuasion are sizable. Chapter 3. The importance of attention is importance. For an unrelated reason, I was fortunate to be in London to witness a set of extraordinary festivities commemorating the 50th anniversary of Elizabeth II's accession to the throne of England. Although the Queen had been traveling the globe for months to Commonwealth nations, hosting Golden Jubilee events in her name, the celebrations peaked on June 4, 2002, with a program on the Mall in London that drew over 1 million well-wishers from around Britain and the world. The marked adulation surprised many in the national press, who predicted the Jubilee would be a fizzle, demonstrating the modern-day irrelevance of the British monarchy in general, and of Her Royal Highness in particular. The opposite proved to be the case. In the several weeks run-up to June 4th, throngs within the United Kingdom flocked to dedications, parades, concerts, and special proceedings honoring the Queen, which she honored in turn with her presence. Especially coveted were invitations to small parties, where it was sometimes possible to be addressed personally by the Queen in a receiving line. Of course, the opportunity to meet Elizabeth II under any circumstances would be considered exceptional, but the chance to meet her amid the pomp and pageantry of the Golden Jubilee added even more significance to such occasions, which were widely reported by the media. One report stood out from all the others for me. A young woman moving through a reception line at one of the small fetes experienced the horror of hearing the cell phone in her purse begin to ring just as she met the Queen. Flustered and frozen with embarrassment as her phone pealed insistently, she stared helplessly into the royal eyes that had become fixed on her bag. Finally, Elizabeth leaned forward and advised, "You should answer that, dear. It might be someone important." What's salient is important. While the graciousness of Elizabeth's advice offers an insight into her beloved standing among her subjects, the content of that advice offers another type of insight. Anything that draws focused attention to itself can lead observers to overestimate its importance. Who, on the other end of the line, could conceivably have been more important at that singular moment than Her Majesty, the Queen of the Realm, on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of her reign? I can't think of anyone. Yet the unknown caller was proclaimed worthy of it by the Queen, no less. Now, a critic might argue that Elizabeth didn't overestimate the potential import of the caller one whit, that her response was born of a characteristic personal tendency toward kindness, and not at all of a characteristic human tendency toward misassessment in that sort of situation. The critic would be wrong, I believe, because although royals are often said to be of a different breed than the rest of us, they are not of a different species. Numerous researchers have documented the basic human inclination to assign undue weight to whatever happens to be salient at the time. One of those researchers is Daniel Kahneman, who, for personal and professional reasons, is an excellent informant on the character and causes of human behavior. On the personal side, he's been able to observe from within a multitude of cultures and roles. Having grown up in France, earned degrees in Jerusalem, Israel, and Berkeley, California, served as a soldier and personnel assessor in Israel, and taught in Canada and the United States. More impressive, though, are Kahneman's credentials as a renowned authority on matters of human psychology. His teaching positions have always been prestigious, culminating with an appointment at Princeton University that included simultaneous professorships in psychology and public affairs. His numerous awards have also been prestigious, but none as noteworthy as the 2002 Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences, the only Nobel in history given to an individual trained as a psychologist. It's no wonder, then, that when Daniel Kahneman speaks on issues of human psychology, he gets hushed attention. I am reminded of a famous television commercial of many years ago for the financial services firm E.F. Hutton that depicts a pair of businessmen in a busy restaurant trying to talk over the din of clanking silverware, loud waiters, and neighboring table conversations. One of the men says to his colleague, "Well, my broker is E.F. Hutton," and E.F. Hutton says, "The place goes silent. Waiters stop taking orders, busboys stop clearing tables, diners stop speaking, while everyone in the room turns to take in the advice, and an announcer's voice intones, 'When E.F. Hutton talks, people listen.'" I've been to several scientific conferences at which Professor Kahneman has spoken, and when Daniel Kahneman talks, people listen. I am invariably among them. So I took special notice of his answer to a fascinating challenge put to him not long ago by an online discussion site. He was asked to specify the one scientific concept that, if appreciated properly, would most improve everyone's understanding of the world. Although in response he provided a full 500-word essay describing what he called the focusing illusion, his answer is neatly summarized in the essay's title: "Nothing in life is as important as you think it is while you are thinking about it." The implications of Kahneman's assertion apply to much more than the momentary status of the caller to a ringing phone. They apply tellingly well to the practice of persuasion, because a communicator who gets an audience to focus on a key element of a message preloads it with importance. This form of persuasion accounts for what many see as the principal role, labeled agenda setting, that the news media play in influencing public opinion. The central tenet of agenda-setting theory is that the media rarely produce change directly by presenting compelling evidence that sweeps an audience to new positions. They are much more likely to persuade indirectly by giving selected issues and facts better coverage than other issues and facts. It's this coverage that leads audience members, by virtue of the greater attention they devote to certain topics, to decide that these are the most important to be taken into consideration when adopting a position. As the political scientist Bernard Cohen wrote, "The press may not be successful most of the time in telling people what to think, but it is stunningly successful in telling them what to think about." According to this view, in an election, whichever political party is seen by voters to have the superior stance on the issue highest on the media's agenda at the moment will likely win. That outcome shouldn't seem troubling, provided the media have highlighted the issue or set of issues most critical to the society at the time of the vote. Regrettably, other factors often contribute to coverage choices, such as whether a matter is simple or complicated, gripping or boring, familiar or unfamiliar to newsroom staffers, inexpensive or expensive to examine, and even friendly or not to the news director's political leanings. In the summer of 2000, a pipe bomb exploded at the main train station in Dusseldorf, Germany, injuring several Eastern European immigrants. Although no proof was ever found, Officials suspected from the start that a fringe right-wing group with an anti-immigrant agenda was responsible. A sensational aspect of the story, one of the victims not only lost a leg in the blast, but also the baby in her womb, stimulated a rash of news stories in the following month regarding right-wing extremism in Germany. Polls taken at the same time showed that the percentage of Germans who rated right-wing extremism as the most important issue facing their country spiked from near zero to 35%, a percentage that sank back to near zero again as related news reports disappeared in subsequent months. A similar effect appeared more recently in the United States. As the 10th anniversary of the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001 approached, 9/11 related media stories peaked in the days immediately surrounding the anniversary date and then dropped off rapidly in the weeks thereafter. Surveys conducted during those times asked citizens to nominate two especially important events from the past 70 years. 2 weeks prior to the anniversary, before the media blitz began in earnest, about 30% of respondents named 9/11. But as the anniversary drew closer and the media treatment intensified, survey respondents started identifying 9/11 in increasing numbers to a high of 65%. 2 weeks later, though, after reportage had died down to earlier levels, once again only about 30% of the participants placed it among their two especially important events of the past 70 years. Clearly, the amount of news coverage can make a big difference in the perceived significance of an issue among observers as they are exposed to the coverage. Why do we typically assume that whatever we are focusing on in the moment is especially important? One reason is that whatever we are focusing on typically is especially important in the moment. It's only reasonable to give heightened attention to those factors that have the most significance and utility for us in a particular situation. A strange noise in the dark, the smell of smoke in a theater, a CEO standing to speak. Non-human species have worked this out too, and have evolved similar priorities. Rhesus monkeys, for example, will pay in the form of sacrificed food rewards just for the opportunity to view important, high-status members of their colony. But they will require a reward to divert their attention to unimportant members. In all kinds of species and for all kinds of reasons, it makes great sense to direct attention to those options that scale largest in rank. This sensible system of focusing our limited attentional resources on what does indeed possess special import has an imperfection, though. We can be brought to the mistaken belief that something is important merely because we have been led by some irrelevant factor to give it our narrowed attention. All too often, people believe that if they have paid attention to an idea or event or group, it must be important enough to warrant the consideration. That's not true, as the German and U.S. agenda-setting examples revealed. In those instances, news coverage driven by a sensationalistic or timely story element grabbed audience attention and changed where it was concentrated. In turn, that changed focus influenced viewers' importance judgments of national issues. After recognizing the extent of our vulnerability to the focusing illusion, I've come at last to appreciate a standard saying of Hollywood press agents: there's no such thing as bad publicity. I'd always thought the statement nonsense, as there are memorable instances of bad publicity deflating the reputation and earnings of one or another high-profile figure. Golfer Tiger Woods is losing an estimated $22 million per year in endorsement revenues shortly after his sex scandal became public in 2009 is one example. But now I see how the idea, while false in one respect, can be true in another. It's often said that the fate celebrities fear most is to be ignored, forgotten, or otherwise dropped from the cultural consciousness. Powerful publicity of any sort spares them that worst of all fates because it brings them attention, and raw attention anoints them with presumed importance. Especially in the arts, where one's worth is almost entirely subjective, an elevated public presence contributes to that worth. Accordingly, people will pay to see high-profile celebrities within their performances, productions, and appearances because they, as individuals, seem to matter. Monkey colonies aren't the only environments where residents will pay to watch seemingly important figures. Thus, the persuader who artfully draws outsized attention to the most favorable feature of an offer becomes a successful persuader. That is, he or she becomes effective not just in a straightforward attention-based way, by arranging for audiences to consider that feature fully, but also by arranging for them to lend the feature exaggerated significance even before they have examined it. When audience members do then consider it fully, they experience a double-barreled effect. They are likely to be convinced that the attribute is especially desirable by the one-sidedness of the evidence they've been directed toward, and to view that attribute as especially important besides. Back roads to attention. It is rousing and worrisome, depending on whether you are playing offense or defense, to recognize that these persuasive outcomes can flow from attention-shifting techniques so slight as to go unrecognized as agents of change. Let's consider three ways communicators have used such subtle tactics to great effect. Managing the background. Suppose you've started an online furniture store that specializes in various types of sofas. Some are attractive to customers because of their comfort, and others because of their price. Is there anything you can think to do that would incline visitors to your website to focus on the feature of comfort and, consequently, to prefer to make a sofa purchase that prioritized it over cost? You've no need to labor long for an answer, because two marketing professors, Naomi Mandel and Eric Johnson, have provided one in a set of studies using just such an online furniture site. When I interviewed Mandel regarding why she decided on this particular set of issues to explore, she said her choice had to do with two big unresolved matters within the field of marketing, one relatively recent and one long-standing. The new topic at the time was e-commerce. When she began the research project in the late 1990s, the impact of virtual stores such as Amazon and eBay was only beginning to be seen. But how to optimize success within this form of exchange had not been addressed systematically. So she and Johnson opted for a virtual store site as the context for their study. The other matter that had piqued Mandel's interest is one that has vexed merchandisers forever. How to avoid losing business to a poorer quality rival whose only competitive advantage is lower cost. That is why Mandel chose to pit higher quality furniture lines against less expensive, inferior ones in her study. It's a traditional problem that the business-savvy students in our marketing courses raise all the time, she said. We always instruct them not to get caught up in a price war against an inferior product, because they'll lose. We tell them to make quality the battleground instead, because that's a fight they'll most likely win. Fortunately for me, she continued, the best of the students in those classes have never been satisfied with that general advice. They'd say, yeah, but how? And I never really had a good answer for them, which gave me a great question to pursue for my research project. Fortunately for us, after analyzing their results, Mandel and Johnson were in a position to deliver a stunningly simple answer to the yeah, but how question. In an article largely overlooked since it was published in 2002, They described how they were able to draw website visitors' attention to the goal of comfort merely by placing fluffy clouds on the background wallpaper of the site's landing page. That maneuver led those visitors to assign elevated levels of importance to comfort when asked what they were looking for in a sofa. Those same visitors also became more likely to search the site for information about the comfort features of the sofas in stock, and, most notably, to choose a more comfortable and more costly sofa as their preferred purchase. To make sure their results were due to the landing page wallpaper and not to some general human preference for comfort, Mandel and Johnson reversed their procedure for other visitors, who saw wallpaper that pulled their attention to the goal of economy by depicting pennies instead of clouds. These visitors assigned greater levels of importance to price, searched the site primarily for cost information, and preferred an inexpensive sofa. Remarkably, despite having their importance ratings, search behavior, and buying preferences all altered persuasively by the landing page wallpaper, when questioned afterward, most participants refused to believe that the depicted clouds or pennies had affected them in any way. Additional research has found similarly sly effects for online banner ads, the sort we all assume we can ignore without impact while we read. Well-executed research has shown us mistaken in this regard. While reading an online article about education, repeated exposure to a banner ad for a new brand of camera made the reader significantly more favorable to the ad when they were shown it again later. Tellingly, this effect emerged even though they couldn't recall having ever seen the ad, which had been presented to them in 5-second flashes near the story material. Further, the more often the ad had appeared while they were reading the article, the more they came to like it. This last finding deserves elaboration, because it runs counter to abundant evidence that most ads experience a wear-out effect after they have been encountered repeatedly, with observers tiring of them or losing trust in advertisers who seem to think that their message is so weak that they need to send it over and over. Why didn't these banner ads, which were presented as many as 20 times within just 5 pages of text, suffer any wear out? The readers never processed the ads consciously, so there was no recognized information to be identified as tedious or untrustworthy. These results pose a fascinating possibility for online advertisers. Recognition recall, a widely used index of success for all other forms of ads, might greatly underestimate the effectiveness of banner ads. In the new studies, frequently interjected banners were positively rated and were uncommonly resistant to standard wear-out effects, yet they were neither recognized nor recalled. Indeed, it looks to be this third result, lack of direct notice, that makes banner ads so effective in the first two strong and stubborn ways. After many decades of using recognition recall as a prime indicator of an ad's value, who in the advertising community would have thought that the absence of memory for a commercial message could be a plus? Within the outcomes of the wallpaper and the banner ad studies is a larger lesson regarding the communication process. Seemingly dismissible information presented in the background captures a valuable kind of attention that allows for potent, almost entirely uncounted instances of influence. The influence isn't always desirable, however. In this regard, there's a body of data on consequential background factors that parents especially should take into account. Environmental noise, such as that coming from heavy traffic or airplane flight paths, is something we think we get used to and even block out after a while. But the evidence is clear that the disruptive noise still gets in, reducing the ability to learn and perform cognitive tasks. One study found that the reading scores of students in a New York City elementary school were significantly lower if their classrooms were situated close to elevated subway tracks on which trains rattled past every 4 to 5 minutes. When the researchers, armed with their findings, pressed New York City transit system officials and Board of Education members to install noise-dampening materials on the tracks and in the classrooms, students' scores jumped back up. Similar results have been found for children near airplane flight paths. When the city of Munich, Germany, moved its airport, the memory and reading scores of children near the new location plummeted, while those near the old location rose significantly. Thus, parents whose children's schools or homes are subjected to intermittent automotive, train, or aircraft noise should insist on the implementation of sound-baffling remedies. Employers, for the sake of their workers and their own bottom lines, should do the same. Teachers need to consider the potentially negative effects of another kind of distracting background stimuli, this one of their own making, on young students' learning and performance. Classrooms with heavily decorated walls displaying lots of posters, maps, and artwork reduce the test scores of young children learning science material there. It is clear that background information can both guide and distract focus of attention. Anyone seeking to influence optimally must manage that information thoughtfully. Inviting favorable evaluation. Although communicators can use attention-drawing techniques to amplify the judged importance of a feature or issue, that's not always wise. Relevant here is Bernard Cohen's observation about press coverage, that it doesn't so much tell people what to think as what to think about. Any practice that pulls attention to an idea will be successful only when the idea has merit. If the arguments and evidence supporting it are seen as meritless by an audience, directed attention to the bad idea won't make it any more persuasive. If anything, the tactic might well backfire. After all, if audience members have come to see an idea as more important to them than before, they should then be even more likely to oppose it when it is a plainly poor one. Indeed, a lot of research has demonstrated that the more consideration people give to something, the more extreme, polarized, their opinions of it become. So attention-capturing tactics provide no panacea to would-be persuaders. Still, if you have a good case to make, there are certain places where those tactics will give your persuasive appeal special traction. One such place is in a field of strong competitors. In modern business, it is becoming increasingly difficult to outpace one's rivals. Easily copied advances in development technologies, production techniques, and business methods make it hard for a company to distinguish the essence of what it offers. Bottled water, gasoline, insurance, air travel, banking services, industrial machinery, from what other contestants for the same market can deliver. To deal with the problem, alternative ways of creating separation have to be tried. Retailers can establish multiple convenient locations. Wholesalers can put big sales staffs into the field. Manufacturers can grant broad guarantees. Service providers can assemble extensive customer care units. And they all can engage in large-scale advertising and promotional efforts to create and maintain brand prominence. But there's a downside to such fixes. Because these means of differentiation are so costly, their expense might be too burdensome for many organizations to bear. Could resolving the dilemma lie in finding an inexpensive way to shift attention to a particular product, service, or idea? Well, yes, as long as the spotlighted item is a good one, a high scorer in customer reviews, perhaps. Critical here would be to arrange for observers to focus their attention on that good thing rather than on rivals' equally good options. Then, its favorable features should gain both verification and importance from the scrutiny. Already, some data show that these twin benefits can produce a substantial advantage for a brand when consumers focus on it in isolation from from its competitors. Although the data have come from different settings, shopping malls, college campuses, and websites, and different types of products, cameras, big-screen TVs, VCRs, and laundry detergents, the results all point to the same conclusion. If you agreed to participate in a consumer survey regarding some product, perhaps 35mm cameras, the survey taker could enhance your ratings of any strong brand, let's say Canon, simply by asking you to consider the qualities of Canon cameras, but not asking you to consider the qualities of any of its major rivals, such as Nikon, Olympus, Pentax, or Minolta. More than that, without realizing why, your intention to purchase a Canon 35mm camera would likely also jump, as would your desire to make the purchase straight away, with no need to search for information about comparable brands. However, all of these advantages for Canon would drop away if you'd been asked to consider the qualities of its cameras, but before rating those qualities, to think about the options that Nikon, Olympus, Pentax, and Minolta could provide. Thus, to receive the benefits of focused attention, the key is to keep the focus unitary. Some impressive research demonstrates that merely engaging in a single-shoot evaluation of one of several established hotel and restaurant chains, consumer products, and even charity organizations can automatically cause people to value the focused-upon entity more and become more willing to support it financially. One applicable tactic being employed with increasing frequency by various organizations is to request evaluation of their products and services. Only their products and services. As a consumer, I am routinely asked by providers to consider and rate business performances of one sort or another. Occasionally, I am petitioned through a phone call or direct mail, but typically it is via email. Sometimes I am to evaluate a single experience, such as a recent hotel stay, online purchase, or customer service interaction. Periodically, the "How are we doing?" question asks me to assess features of an ongoing partnership with my travel agency, financial services firm, or phone provider. The requests seem innocent enough and acceptable because they appear intended, as I am sure they are, to gather information that will improve the quality of my commercial exchanges. But I'd be surprised if my compliance didn't also give the petitioners, especially the highly ranked ones, a hidden bonus. My focused attention to their mostly favorable facets with no comparable attention to the mostly favorable facets of their ablest rivals. Other research has extended these findings to the way that leaders and managers make strategic choices inside their organizations. Individuals assign the responsibility for reversing a sales slump within a paint manufacturing company took part in a study. Each was asked to evaluate the wisdom of only one of four worthy possible solutions. One, increasing the advertising budget, which would raise brand awareness among do-it-yourself painters. Two, lowering prices, which would attract more price-sensitive buyers. Three, hiring additional sales representatives who could press for more shelf space in retail stores. Or four, investing in product development to boost quality so that the brand could be promoted to professional painters as the best in the market. It didn't matter which of the four ideas the decision makers evaluated. The process of targeting and evaluating one by itself pushed them to recommend it among the options as the best remedy for the company to adopt. But surely the typical highly placed decision maker wouldn't settle on an important course of action without evaluating all viable alternatives fully. And he or she certainly wouldn't make that choice after evaluating just one strong option, right? Wrong and wrong, for a pair of reasons. First, a thorough analysis of all legitimate roads to success is time-consuming, requiring potentially lengthy delays for identifying, vetting, and then mapping out each of the promising routes. And highly placed decision-makers didn't get to their lofty positions by being known as bottlenecks inside their organizations. Second, for any decision maker, a painstaking comparative assessment of multiple options is difficult and stressful, akin to the juggler's task of trying to keep several objects in the air all at once. The resultant and understandable tendency is to avoid or abbreviate such an arduous process by selecting the first practicable candidate that presents itself. This tendency has a quirky name, satisficing, a term coined by economist and Nobel laureate Herbert Simon to serve as a blend of the words satisfy and suffice. The combination reflects two simultaneous goals of a chooser when facing a decision, to make it good and to make it gone, which, according to Simon, usually means making it good enough. Although in an ideal world one would work and wait until the optimal solution emerged, in the real world of mental overload, limited resources, and deadlines, satisficing is the norm. But even courses of action selected in this manner should not be allowed the unfair advantages of a different sort of unitary assessment, one focused only on upsides. In the excitement of a looming opportunity, decision makers are infamous for concentrating on what a strategy could do for them if it succeeded, and not enough, or at all, on what it could do to them if it failed. To combat this potentially ruinous over-optimism, time needs to be devoted, systematically, to addressing a pair of questions that often don't arise by themselves. What future events could make this plan go wrong, and what would happen to us if it did go wrong? Decision scientists who have studied this consider the opposite tactic have found it both easy to implement and remarkably effective at de-biasing judgments. The benefits to the organization that strives to rid itself of this and other decision-making biases can be considerable. One study of over 1,000 companies determined that those employing sound judgment de-biasing processes enjoyed a 5% to 7% advantage in return on investment over those failing to use such approaches. Shifting the task at hand. On March 20, 2003, President George W. Bush ordered an invasion of Iraq by U.S.-led forces. After a series of rapid military strikes that crushed the government of Saddam Hussein, it eventuated in an extended, agonizing, and brutal slog that cost the United States dearly in blood, money, prestige, and global influence. The Bush administration's initial justification for the war, to rid the region of Saddam's cache of weapons of mass destruction, was debunked. The weapons never materialized, and was revised regularly to incorporate such new purposes as eliminating Saddam's humanitarian abuses, terminating Iraq's support of al-Qaeda, safeguarding the world's oil supply, and establishing a bulwark for democracy in the Middle East. Nonetheless, the administration deflected attention from these questionable and shifting reasons through an ingenious media program, one that had the effect of directing the public's gaze away from the larger rationale for the war and on to its daily execution. That outcome was neatly accomplished by changing the task that representatives of the world's most important news agencies set for themselves in covering the conflict. The embedded reporter program of the war in Iraq was the product of a joint decision by U.S. officials and major media bureau chiefs to place reporters directly within combat units, to eat, sleep, and travel with them during the course of military operations. Although the exact numbers vary depending on the source, at the program's height, between 600 and 700 media representatives had the kind of access to the hostilities that had been denied them by U.S. decision-makers in the 1991 Gulf War and prior military operations in Afghanistan. Partly as a way to better ensure the safety of all concerned, and partly as a public relations move, the U.S. military developed the idea for the program with direction from Bush administration public affairs officials in the Department of Defense. To media heads, the advantages of the program were obvious and exciting. With their personnel functioning alongside the troops in almost every sense, they would be able to convey to their audiences the experience of combat with levels of detail and currency rarely available to them before. The prospect of viscerally engaging video, graphic photographs, and riveting first-person accounts offered a dream come true to news organizations that had chafed under the information restrictions of earlier military campaigns. Besides a window into the reality of soldiering, their live-in status would allow embedded reporters special access to the soldiers themselves, and thus to the personal circumstances of these men and women. Those human interest stories are also highly coveted by news media for their audience-drawing powers. One study found that embedded reporters were able to include such human interest elements in over a third of their stories, whereas unembedded reporters could do so in only 1% of theirs. To U.S. officials, the advantages of the program were different but no less compelling. First, under the wings of armed protectors, risks to the various media personnel in Iraq could be reduced significantly. The possibility of hundreds of news people trying to find headline-grabbing stories in a war zone, and instead finding themselves hostages, casualties, or in need of rescue, was a headache the military wanted to avoid. Also, the personal observations of journalists from around the world, nearly 40% of embedded slots went to non-U.S. news agencies, provided an invaluable kind of risk protection to the military, from possible untruths about the war coming from Saddam's government. As Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs Brian Whitman put it, embedded reporters would be in a direct position to undercut the credibility of what the Iraqi Defense Ministry might be putting out. There was a third, much larger benefit to the armed forces as well. Because the media chiefs were so attracted to the idea of an embedded reporter program, they made concessions that slanted the coverage more favorably to the military, which was allowed to play a role in the training, selection, and dismissal of reporters, as well as to review their reports prior to publication. At an academic conference 1 year after the invasion, Colonel Rick Long, who was head of media relations for the U.S. Marine Corps, was asked why the military advocated for the program. His answer could not have been more straightforward. "Frankly, our job is to win the war. Part of that is information warfare. So we are going to attempt to dominate the information environment. Overall, we were very happy with the outcome." Colonel Long and his colleagues had every right to be happy. Research analyzing the stories coming out of Iraq at the time detected a more positive tilt toward the military in those written by embedded reporters. But this disparity in tone was modest compared with another difference between the reports of embedded and unembedded journalists. It was a difference that served the purposes of the Bush administration more than those of the military personnel on the ground. Embedded reporters' accounts were focused almost entirely on the troops, their daily activities, food, clothing, and supplies, how they prepared for battles, the tactics they employed, and the bravery they showed in battle. Indeed, 93% of all stories filed by embedded journalists came from the soldiers' perspectives, compared with less than half of that from their unembedded counterparts. And because, for the most part, the armed services had done a good job of feeding, clothing, supplying, and training the soldiers, who, for the most part, performed effectively and courageously, the military had a strong case to exhibit to those who could report on it firsthand. Something crucial was lost, though, in this deepened but narrowed coverage. The embedded journalists, whose reports received an astonishing 71% of front-page war coverage during the conflict, were not reporting in any meaningful way on the broader political issues involved, such as the justifications for the war. As an example, the absence of weapons of mass destruction was mentioned in just 2% of all stories, or the operation's impact on U.S. standing and power abroad. How could we expect anything else of them? Their eager superiors assigned them to cover what one analysis termed the minutiae of the conflict, which absorbed all of their time, energy, and consideration. Home again.